This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents We Are Never Meeting in Real Life, Essays. This is the author, Samantha Irby. My bachelorette application. I'm squeezed into my push-up bra and sparkly, ill-fitting dress. I've got the requisite 16 coats of waterproof mascara, black eyeliner, and salmon-colored streaks of hastily applied self-tanner drawing down the side of my neck. I'm sucking in my stomach. I've taken 37 Imodium in case my irritable bowels have an adverse reaction to the bag of tacos I hid in my purse and ate in the bathroom while no one was looking. And I've been listening to Katy Perry really, really loudly in the limo on the way over here. I'm about to crush a beer can on my forehead. Let's do this, bro. Are you nominating someone or applying yourself? I'm applying myself. Name, Samantha McKeever Irby. Age, 35-ish, but I could pass for 47 to 52 easily. 60-something if I stay up all night. Gender, passably female. Height, 5'9". Weight, Lane Bryant model, but maybe on her period week. I have significantly large ankles. Occupation, my technical job title is Client Services Director at the Animal Hospital where I've worked since early 2002, which loosely translates to surly phone answerer and unfriendly door opener. I'm pretty lazy, although I am quite good at playing the race card and eating other people's lunches in the break room. What is the next big city near you, and how far is it? Chicago. And it's 0 miles away. I mean, I'm in it right now, doing Chicago things. You know, eating a deep dish pizza while wearing a beat-up Urlacher jersey and sprinkling pieces of the Sears Tower. No real Chicagoan will ever call it the Willis Tower, on top and reading Oprah magazine. Chicago. How did you hear about our search? I have a television, and I do most of my reading while waiting in line to buy diet yogurt at the grocery store. What is your highest level of education? High school, but I took a lot of honors classes. Where were you born? Evanston, Illinois, a suburb along the lake due north of Chicago and the birthplace of hella luminaries like Marlon Brando, the Cusacks, Donald Rumsfeld, gross, Bill Murray, Becky number one from the TV show Roseanne, and possibly Eddie Vedder. At least, I think so. We all believe that the song Elderly Woman in a Small Town is about us. But we have 3 motherfucking Whole Foods. That most certainly qualifies us as a medium town, at the very least. Maybe that dude really is from someplace else. Where did you grow up? Evanston. And I'm still basically there. All the time. Unlike Eddie Vedder, I can't get out. I work there. My doctor is there. And even though I technically live within the Chicago city limits, if I need to go to the supermarket or the movies, I always think of the Evanston ones first. It's a trap. No one ever leaves this place. Not kidding, I see my junior year English teacher at Starbucks every morning, which is down the block from the bagel shop this dude I graduated with just bought. It's gross. I gotta grow the fuck up. Do you have siblings? How old are they? When I was born, my parents were almost 40 and almost 50, which means I have never seen either of them chase a ball, get down on the floor to help construct a Lego set, or run along behind me as I wobbled on a 2-wheeled bike. I have 3 sisters who are currently, brace yourself, 56, 54, and 51 years old. Hilarious. My sister Carmen is going to be 60 real years old in a few years, and that blows my mind. Is your mom even 60 yet? S-I-X-T-Y. Have you ever been arrested, charged, or convicted of a crime of any type? If so, please give details. I was arrested for shoplifting once when I was 14. Before you write me off as a wayward little thug, hear me out. So I have that disease that a lot of poor people who claw their way out of the miserable depths of poverty suffer from. The one that makes you want to blow your paycheck on all the special things, because never before in your life could you ever have had anything even remotely fancy or expensive. But I was a teenage girl, and I needed lipstick, and I couldn't wait the 2 years it would take for me to pick up regular babysitting work. So I went to the Osco in downtown Evanston one afternoon and slipped tubes of Revlon's Toast of New York and iced coffee. It was the 90s, brown lips were the thing, into my coat pocket and tried to nonchalantly waltz out of the store like they hadn't had what I was looking for. I was met at the door by a stern-faced manager, an older black gentleman whose disappointment in me was palpable. "Is this what Martin Luther King marched for?" he grumbled under his breath as he led me to the room with the mops where a handful of morose-looking degenerates were eating lunch. "Pretty sure Revlon is owned by white people, but I didn't want to further piss him and the ancestors off." He sat me in a rickety office chair, and I surveyed discarded Employee of the Month photos, fanned like a deck of cards across the threadbare carpet while he called the police. When the portly, red-faced officer showed up, I was deep in a REM cycle, snoring hard with my head on someone's particle board desk. As the cop escorted me to the waiting patrol car, we passed Morgan Freeman dragging a homeless-looking black dude with bottles of Tylenol and Advil spilling out of his overstuffed pockets back to the makeshift holding cell. Blood trickled from a gash on his forehead. "That guy must have some headache, eh?" the officer chuckled. "What a tacky asshole." Arrested might be a stretch. What happened next involved me lying as flat as humanly possible across the back seat of the police cruiser as the officer drove like he was in a fucking parade, 7 miles an hour, through throngs of my recently dismissed classmates. I imagine them straining on tiptoe to see who might be in the back seat. My mildly disappointed sister met us at the curb and assured the officer it would never happen again. That is the extent of my criminal history. Have you ever had a temporary restraining order issued against someone or had one issued against you? If so, please give details and dates. No, but when I was 19, I used to stalk this dude I went to high school with. I would close up the bread shop where I worked, take one of the loaves that was intended for donation to the soup kitchen, then drive my car to his parents' house and park close enough to see inside, but far enough away to be inconspicuous. Then I would sit there with the engine running, tearing off chunks of apple cinnamon bread and listening to De La Soul while imagining our life together. I am a deeply troubled person. Have you ever filed for bankruptcy or Chapter 11? No, but I wish I had thought about that shit years ago before I decided to overdraw on an old bank account. Do not walk away from an overdrawn checking account, friends. Why didn't anyone ever teach me that shit? I mean, someone should write a primer for adulthood that's just 2 or 3 sentences long. 1, wear clothing that actually fucking fits. 2, buy drugs from reputable dealers only. 3, do not walk away from an overdrawn checking account. I could have been such a better human. Have you ever auditioned for or been a performer, participant, or contestant on a reality or other TV or radio show or in a film? What are the rules as far as comedy podcasts and rudimentary videos of stage performances recorded on shitty camera phones and uploaded to YouTube by assholes? Do those count? Do you drink alcoholic beverages? Do I? What's your favorite drink? I don't believe in pretending to be cool anymore. If I did, I would tell you that I enjoy two fingers of nicely aged bourbon, neat with a water back. In real life, I drink daiquiris and skinny girl margaritas and shit like cupcake flavored vodka. Also, I really love beer, but not any of the impressive kinds that you order to show how exceptional you are. I basically drink like a sorority pledge. Have you ever been married or engaged? Nope. Do you have any children? I'm counting the cat here, so yes. Are you genuinely looking to get married, and why? Honestly, I don't know, homie. Marriage seems so hard. I mean, even the ones on television look like they just take so much goddamn work. I'm lazy. Plus, getting out of one seems ridiculously expensive. And then, when you get divorced, after all of the crying and draining of mutual bank accounts before your partner gets a chance to, you have to cut the children in half, which is probably very bloody and messy. You know, what I really need is someone who remembers to rotate this meaty pre-corpse toward the sun every couple of days and tries to get me to stop spending my money like a goddamn NBA lottery pick. Why would you want to find your spouse on our TV show? Have you been to the club lately? Shit's fucking dire, man. Also, I need someone to watch Shark Tank with, and I feel like that's a spousal kind of expectation. Can't just ask your casual booty call to commit to spending Friday nights indoors arguing over the valuation of some at-home mom's jelly and jam business. And I'm too poor to run multiple background checks. Please describe your ideal mate in terms of physical attraction and in terms of personality attraction. Physical attraction? Not a real thing. If, at 36 years old, I'm sitting over here talking about chiseled abs and perfect teeth, then I am undeserving of genuine romantic love. I have slept with a handful of conventionally attractive humans, the prettiest of whom was this dude who worked at Best Buy and kind of resembled So Anxious era Ginuwine. He was boring and lazy and totally caught off guard when I pointed those facts out to him. No one ever tells attractive children how much they suck, and then the rest of us get stuck with insufferable, narcissistic adults who can barely tie their shoes because someone else is busy either doing it for them or congratulating them on their effort. I do not have the energy to be in a relationship with someone exceptionally good-looking. I don't know what an attractive personality is. I like charisma and charm, but what I really need to find is someone who doesn't get on my nerves, but is also minimally annoyed by all the irritating things about me. That is my basic understanding of relationships at this point in my life, that it all comes down to finding someone too lazy to cheat and who doesn't want to stab her ears out every time I speak. How many serious relationships have you been in, and how long were they? If I'm being honest, the answer is probably two. And if I'm really being transparent, one of those was mostly sexless bullshit, and the other spent half our relationship going to Barbados with women who weren't me, so none. What happened to end those relationships? Irreconcilable differences. What have you not found but would like to have in a relationship? Someone who will leave me the hell alone for extended periods of time without getting all weird about it. I have a lot of audiobooks to listen to on the toilet. What are your hobbies and interests? Hobbies, eating snacks, sleeping during the day, scrolling through Facebook quickly enough that people's stupid videos don't start playing automatically, listening to slow jams. I pretend to be interested in a lot of things. Art, theater, recycling, donating to things, expensive varietals of coffee. But mostly I just watch television and read celebrity gossip on the internet while getting most of my important news from Twitter, which I don't even really like that much. I'm interested in animals and novels and red lipstick, but let's just say world issues and social justice, so I sound kind of smart to the viewing audience. Do you have any pets? I have a cat child named Helen Keller. I believe we've been over this already. What accomplishment are you most proud of? If this is a real audiobook that someone is actually listening to, then this is my proudest achievement. Also, learning to drive stick while wearing flip-flops. You have to be kind of a genius to do that, for real. The Bachelorette is my guilty pleasure jam. That may come as a surprise to some of you, but you should already know that a show where a woman is surrounded by 25 slabs of brisket, clamoring to brazenly drink her dirty bathwater and massage the corns on her toes in front of the entire country, is 100% my kind of party. I love watching a man humiliate himself. I wish it was on every night, particularly the introductory episode, when we get to meet all the software sales executives and tax accountants and telecommunication marketers as they line up in their finest suits, teeth flossed and smelling good, forced to do the, "Hi, please date me," tap dance women are perpetually performing. Seriously, I used to try to neatly cram everything remotely interesting about me into my, "Hey, nice to meet you. I am elevator pitch." Now that I know impressing a stranger isn't worth the effort, I don't do it anymore. I just assume every man I meet is bored and hates me. I can barely be bothered to give one a high five before writing down my email and saying, "Get at me if you want." So it is especially heartening to watch these smarmy, desperate clowns crawling all over one another like rats, trying to get the attention of these free spirits and dog lovers who will eventually make them burst into real tears on national television. The Bachelorette proves that men are as petty and vapid and ridiculous as women are made to seem. They're just better at hiding it because they get to be real men and sulk and brood and bottle everything up. These dudes are backstabbing drama queens who are constantly cutting one another down, throwing shade all over the place, and casting more side eyes than a Siamese cat, all for a girl who, I must remind you, could probably not do long division by hand. And why shouldn't they? Because every single one of these dudes is as boring as a glass of tap water, while the Bachelorette is beautiful and friendly and forced to sit in a dress in sequins that have got to be digging uncomfortably into the backs of her thighs. I've never sat down to watch a marathon of episodes stored on my DVR and thought, "Boy, does he seem interesting," about any one of the candidates up for sex election. Let's hit pause on the remote for a second here and say that I do pay very close attention to one or two members of the cast. The black ones, clinging for dear life to the inner tubes as they drift helplessly toward the deep end of the dating pool. No, she's never going to pick Marcus or Jonathan, but she will keep them on life support for however many episodes it takes to satisfy the NAACP. I watch that shit like a hawk, like This date better not include a fun trip in a marsh boat on the old Magnolia plantation. Or, if they serve these dudes a piece of fried chicken, I will throw this TV out the window. I usually fall off by the time they get down to the final two, because romance is a lie and true love an impossibility. Any asshole can fall in love on a private beach in a tropical locale, surrounded by lush flora and adorable fauna, shining suns, and chirping birds. Give me 10 uninterrupted minutes without some ding-dong demanding something or subtweeting me or making me do work, and I could fall in love with my worst fucking enemy. Seriously, what's not to love about being expertly lit and drunk at 2 in the afternoon? But I'm gonna need you to love me on the bus, dude, and first thing in the morning. Also, when I'm drunk and refuse to shut up about getting McNuggets from the drive-thru. When I fall asleep in the middle of that movie you paid extra to see in IMAX. When I wear the flowered robe I got at Walmart and the sweatpants I made into sweatshorts to bed. When I'm blasting More and More by Blood, Sweat, and Tears at 7 on a Sunday morning while cleaning the kitchen and fucking up your mom's frittata recipe. When I bring half a dozen gross, mangled kittens home to foster for a few nights and they shit everywhere and pee on your side of the bed. When I go grocery shopping and come back with only a bag of Fritos and 5 pounds of pork tenderloin. When I'm sick and stumbling around the crib with half a roll of toilet paper shoved in each nostril. When I beg you 14 times to read something I've written, then get mad when you tell me what you don't like about it, and I call you an uneducated idiot piece of shit. Lovebird City. If there was an alternate universe where I could remake this show starring myself, it would be the best dating show in history. I smell a ratings juggernaut, and it smells like cat pee unsuccessfully laundered from a fitted sheet, seared pork, and adult diapers. Fetch me a camera crew. Here are my qualifications. 1. I'm fat and black. Isn't it about time they had a bitch with a real 2% large cottage cheese curd ass on this awkward date parade? I mean, come on. Welcome to your after photo, gentlemen. Primetime television needs some real talk from a real asshole, and that asshole should be me. But they have to make sure they cast a bunch of Latinx and one white guy with dreadlocks who you can rest assured wouldn't be a real contender. 2. Instead of roses, I would hand out condoms. Because I'm not living in a house with 20 hot dudes I can't get naked with. You must be crazy. And you better believe those elimination ceremonies are taking place in the bedroom. No foreplay, no rose. Keeps his socks on during, no rose. Rabbit fucking, no rose. Takes too long to come and starts chafing my haunches, no rose. Blows air into my vagina, no rose. Says dumb stuff in bed, no rose. Won't let me get a good up-close look at his butthole? No rose. Won't let me gag him and tie him up for fun, even though that does nothing for me sexually? No bleeping rose. I should probably go get a robe, because my pajamas are just retired exercise clothes, and if I'm going to be kicking dudes out while their dicks are still sticky, I want to make sure I look as classy as possible. If the JCPenney catalog is to be believed, a bathrobe is a surefire way of achieving that. 3. I would plan realistic dates. Do you really want to watch me giggle and squeal and pretend not to be scared out of my mind because we're going hang gliding or rock climbing or whatever other challenges these guys typically participate in? Do you really want to watch me bowling and roller skating with a group of sexy dudes? No, you do not. What you really want to watch is the Can This Dude Pay For Our Meal at Alinea challenge and the Can Homeboy Sort and Wash His Own Laundry competition. Because if this show is really about marriage, my starry eyes and pinchable cheeks don't matter. That kind of thing only goes so far. I'm sure people get over my dimples easily within 6 fucking months. And then what? Those sharp edges I filed down in front of the cameras are back in full effect, and my real flaws are now comfortable enough to come out and leave halfway through the concert to go take a shit. So to get prepared, we're going to play sexy party games like, can you take a sarcastic joke? And how mad will you get if the cat pukes in your shoe? Or be quiet and play on the computer while Sam is sleeping. And please don't be salty when I put our business on the internet. 4. The network would save so much money on production. We're shooting it in Chicago. And I don't need a fancy wardrobe or stylist. I'd wear my own terrible clothes. That's what these brothers are going to see once they drop to one knee and ask for my paw in marriage anyway. So why front? I don't wear evening gowns and booty shorts every day. I wear daytime pajamas and orthopedic shoes. And lately I've become a big fan of the grandpa cardigan. I shave my head, so I don't need a fancy hair person. My barber cuts my hair for $20, and then I rub some African oils on it so it smells good and glistens in the sunlight. Everyone wins. 5. The winner would totally not be forced to propose. If you're ready to commit the rest of your life to me, after a couple of weeks of getting drunk while a camera crew follows us around, you are not a rational person who makes good choices. It would be incredibly flattering, but ill-advised nonetheless. At the end of the season, I'm always surprised when the dudes actually propose, yet not surprised at all when I read in People magazine 2 weeks later that the happy couple has split because he still has feelings for his college sweetheart and the bachelorette can't leave her career as a dental hygienist in New York to move to Montana and run the family dairy farm. The season finale will go something like this. We're sharing a postcoital can of beer and watching Jimmy Fallon. I get up, wearing my robe, to find my bra and to pee for the 37th time while he tries to wake up his erection for round 2. I come back to bed with more beers, a bag of pretzels, and cold leftover pizza. I send a few text messages to other dudes. He eats all my food without offering me any while getting cheese and grease all over my remote and crumbs in my nice sheets. I pee again. I really cannot be out here risking UTIs like they don't hurt like the devil. And he takes a call that I suspect might be from another woman because the parameters of our relationship thus far have been unclear. I can't really say anything, so I just sulk and pretend that nothing is wrong, but I'm totally ignoring him and pulling the duvet to my side as I turn on Sex and the City reruns. I'm a Miranda, and just to make sure he knows I'm really ignoring him, I put on my headphones and crank up my iPod really loud and sigh a lot until he hangs up the phone and says, "What's wrong?" Then I respond, "Nothing," with a little too much aggression in my voice as I flip through the channels like a woman possessed until it dawns on him what my problem is, and he exasperatedly sighs and says, "That was my mom." But it's too late because now he knows I'm a jealous baby and he doesn't want to be my boyfriend anymore. But maybe he'd still like to sleep with me because of that thing I do with my pinky fingers. Then we'll fall into a fitful, uncomfortable sleep, after which he'll decide that he needs to go home, or to the gym, or to ESPN Zone, or wherever you penises like to hang out in your free time. I'll tell him my last name, finally, and he'll promise to get my phone number from Chris Harrison and text me when he gets home. Just like Cinderella. Or on TV. A Blues for Fred. Fred and I ended our relationship on a sticky August afternoon in the summer of 2012. In the years before our introduction in the comments section on a piece I'd written about how I couldn't have sex with a man who didn't think that not having his own checking account by his 30th birthday was a big deal, Fred had flown to New York by himself just to see the Basquiat exhibit. For that, I was grateful, as his passionate description of Basquiat's early graffiti work kept me from having to make polite conversation while huffing up the stairs at the Art Institute in the waning days of summer. I'm pretty sure there was no Instagram way back then, so I was left to my own devices and forced to look closely at Lichtenstein's brushstrokes and read descriptions as the gentle voice from the audio tour guided me from painting to painting, Fred trailing behind me, taking notes in a battered moleskin. If you are a certain type of sap, this is one of those moments. You know, the ones in which you relax long enough to think that this might actually be real and cool, and maybe start thinking about accidentally leaving some allergy meds and an old toothbrush in a dude's bathroom. I had already forgotten a lip balm and my emergency glasses on the bedside table and hidden a case of fancy bottled water in a kitchen cabinet, but visions of 5 inches of available space in his underwear drawer had begun dancing through my head, and I could not get them to shut up. This is the shit that is exciting to you 8 months into a casual sex thing, a thing that might hopefully blossom into something less casual if maybe you play your cards right and have managed not to be too interested or available seeming, that maybe this person who went on vacation with another woman a few months ago might give up some closet real estate so you don't have to either, one, wear pajamas on your dates, or two, go to sleep after the dates in your clothes. I didn't see the end coming, which is not to say that I was surprised, because I wasn't. I just thought that maybe I had more time. I knew that when we had serious grown-up talks about our goals, and mine didn't include much more than king-size bed and lightning-fast wireless internet, that I was eventually in store for a heartfelt yet awkward conversation about my lack of motivation toward property ownership. And that's okay. Dating is totally weird at this age, what with all the pushy relatives and ticking clocks that people have to contend with. At 24, who cares if you drink a couple of beers across from an irresponsible hipster's ironic haircut and then take him home for less than memorable sex? But if you wake up on your 32nd birthday childless and untethered to a human with health benefits who has read more than one book in the previous 12 months, you have to get your ass out of bed and start dating with intention. And maybe people don't really say it that way, but let me clarify that that is precisely what, oh, you're still dating that guy who's an iPod DJ, really means. Fred had a house, man, which was like, LOL, what? My previous life had been filled with so many gentlemen trying to get their dicks sucked in their childhood bedrooms, complete with superhero twin bed sheets in one unforgettable case, that the first night I walked into Fred's actual crib and met his actually spayed Rottweiler, who came bounding down his actual stairs after we'd parked in his actual garage, I almost burst out laughing. I was peeking into cupboards and putting my ear against closed doors, trying to determine whether anyone else lived there. That kind of shit was mind-blowing for a person who once dated a dude with 6 actual roommates. I was like, how much is your 7th of the rent? $37? Anyway, Fred had a kitchen, and in that kitchen was a juicer and a fruit bowl that held 7 perfectly ripened mangoes. I remember being struck by a half-empty bottle of Dawn propping up a sponge on the sink and thinking to myself how amazing it was that this was a dude who used dishes and then washed them. Listen, I don't want you to think I was messing around with men who couldn't tie their own shoes or whatever, but a lot of dudes in their 30s don't have proper washcloths or fresh produce, so when I crossed the threshold of this actual house and didn't immediately trip over 17 barbells and a Rat King of video game controller cords, I kind of lost my shit a little bit. We went on a lot of really good dates, and he never gave me a hard time for trying to rap along with Outkast in the car, or acted weird when I got all giggly and gross watching Michael Fassbender's huge dick waggle around during the movie Shame, which we watched on a tall leather couch with no cracks in it, not a futon or a beanbag or his dad's recliner while he was out of town. Let's talk about the first night we had sex. No, wait. What we really need to get into is the morning after. I woke up in this massive California king with beams of blinding sunlight slicing through the curtains. My man had actual curtains to warm its crispy white sheets. Dude was gone, and in his stead, he'd left a couple of neatly folded fluffy towels and a brand new bar of soap. In the shower, I thought to myself, this motherfucker has got to have a wife, as I blinked shampoo out of my eyes and squeezed expensive conditioner into my palm. But from the look of things, he didn't, unless she used beard sculpting pomade and wore size 13 work boots. He was downstairs blasting Killer Mike and grating potatoes for homemade hash browns, and this might have been the exact moment that my brain exploded, because that kind of thing had happened to me never. Cash for a Starbucks to drink on the train going to work? Sure. 3.5 minutes to sniff at all the dried-up takeout containers in the fridge in search of something vaguely edible before the cab pulls up? Absolutely. But from scratch, blueberry pancakes with turkey bacon, hash browns, and lukewarm mango puree courtesy of the fancy juicer on the counter? Not ever. And that kind of gloriousness continued throughout the course of our relationship. Home-cooked meals that consisted of more than just massive, blackened hunks of charred meats. Seriously, it's either they cook absolutely nothing at all, or pork chops the size of your head on a grill with neither sides nor condiments. Thoughtful, engaging discussions about culture and news. Fresh bars of soap and neatly folded towels every morning for the shower. Despite myself, I got excited. I like to be excited about stuff, and hanging with a dude I could buy a book for who would actually take the time to read it was terribly fucking exciting. I thought Fred was my Love Jones, the black renaissance relationship I'd been waiting for ever since I watched Lorenz Tate chase Nia Long's New York City-bound Amtrak as it departed Chicago's Union Station, my bougie black romance set to a neo-soul soundtrack. I would be the moody, complicated writer, and he the temperamental artist. Ours would be a life filled with poetry readings I couldn't understand, artist lectures I would barely stay awake through, and gallery openings during which I would gracefully field questions about whether I was the inspiration for his finest works. I would write jokes about his dick, of course, but that would be offset by the afternoons spent digging through crates of old jazz records and evenings banging drums and talking about shit like the diaspora with our similarly head-wrapped, natural-haired friends. We had all the ingredients, paintbrushes, record players, notebooks, proximity to the wild hair. I spent an inordinate amount of time concocting our fantasy future. I got dumped pretty much because I cannot have a baby. I could feel every bit of exposed upper arm fat catch a chill in that fancy restaurant he'd suggested, and I instinctively bent my arms and tucked my elbows into my sides for protection as Fred tried to find a nice way to tell me that his imaginary future children were more important than what I thought was a really special thing we had going. An hour before that, we'd been strolling arm in arm through the Liechtenstein, and my heart was still full of all those people and colors And the fact that I was finally having sex with a person who had a membership to the goddamn Art Institute. And now I was being broken up with over a $30 pasta in a grossly unflattering cap sleeve shirt. I set my fork down. Halfway through, when the sad eyes and gentle tone made my mouth slick with humiliation, I attempted to defend myself. I thought it was ridiculous to talk about my gynecological history and the possibilities of adoption with a dude I had met on fucking Facebook, but there I was, trying to fit the ocean into a plastic cup as it tossed and turned me in its waves. I tuned back in as he was saying, so fucking gently, can you really chase a baby around the backyard? He didn't mean it in the mean way, I didn't think. Sometimes even when it feels mean, it isn't, I reminded myself. I glanced down at my left hand, curled in a stiff black brace, my feet in their orthopedic sandals. No, I would not be chasing any of Fred's babies. We broke up, amicably, of course, because I am not one to make a public scene, but then kept having sex for a few weeks because I'm a total idiot. I remember paying the check and collecting his truck from the valet and driving back to his house as if nothing had changed, as if I wasn't feeling raw and exposed and not good enough, and then dancing in his dining room with him as Prince's Erotic City played on the turntable. What kind of asshole wouldn't choose this? What monster would be satisfied with some boring old broodmare when he could just stay with awesome me and get a couple of foster kids or something? And I'm dumb, but not dumb enough to try to talk a dude out of a major life decision. I don't want to be 50 years old, married to a dude who resents me and hates our 17 adopted children and our cats. Then I'd have to cheat on him to get some romance back in my dried-up life, and I'd inevitably be caught by a member of our child army because I'm careless and irresponsible. He'd fall into a deep depression, comforted only by the warm embrace of Crown Royal and Thug Passion. The care of the children would undoubtedly lapse, causing them to take to the streets, robbing old ladies and eating out of dumpsters or whatever. I can't go out like that. So instead, we stopped dancing and watched 20 minutes of porn before having sweaty sex in his giant bed and wasting a tablespoon of his perfectly good semen in my useless birth canal. And then I went home and deleted his number out of my phone. I blocked him on Facebook and unfollowed his Twitter because the one thing I'm good at is never deluding myself that I can handle the out-of-context social media posts of someone I used to have sex with. I am not calloused in the way you need to be to gracefully handle the onslaught of confusing and hurtful images posted online by an ex. And I'm not even talking about, wow, look at my new girlfriend. Our love is forever. I mean, how could you check in at Olive Garden without me, you savage? So he had to go. I don't know how to use apps to hide people's relationship status updates or whatever the fuck. So I wiped my internet slate clean of him and avoided people who would ask me when I was going to get back on fucking Match.com. In the post-Fred era of my life, here's what I would tell myself on your average Tuesday night while absentmindedly massaging some random corporeal swelling with sick-smelling medicated gel. You can just wait, you dummy. Stop trying to be happy now. You can just wait. That I could and or would just wait for everyone else to get old too. That I would just smile and nod supportively while my young, healthy peers ran through exhaustive lists of their carefree romantic encounters, pretending to listen with intention, patiently waiting for the joints in their knees to erode and the discs in their backs to slip out of place so that they'd stop asking me why I didn't put myself out there more, and maybe start to understand firsthand what it feels like to pursue someone romantically when you are 30-something and have a physical disability and your target is also 30-something and does not. How can I swipe left on Tinder when my gnarled and crippled fingers Can't even work that way without a couple Celebrex. My joints are kind of a mess. There is arthritis in the metatarsal joints on the tops of my feet and in my knee joints and my hand joints, and I have nerve palsy and vitamin deficiency in my sciatic nerve, I think. Sometimes when the doctor is rattling off a list of things, it all runs together. This makes my feet tingly, and when I stand up from sitting sometimes, it takes a few seconds. Red, an eternity in real life, when people with normal legs are already hovering awkwardly near the restaurant entrance because they had no idea that it was going to take me so long, pawing awkwardly at the ground, waiting to regain the use of my foot, before I can step down on my left leg. And you should have been bored with this 20 words ago. I walk like a marionette most of the time, which, despite being kind of hilarious, is the absolute worst, because I am a human being and doing in a real world where people grimace behind their windshields and look at you funny if you take too long to uncertainly step down from a high curb when it's snowing. Hobbling clumsily around, limbs akimbo, is the double worst, because none of the real boys ever wants to take Pinocchio out for a glass of wine and a decent piece of meat. And what is my life if it isn't filled with breathless, passionate courtships? I decided to wade back out into the choppy dating waters of the internet a few weeks after Fred and I ended things, because I am not a person for whom meet cutes naturally occur. I don't have a dog to walk through a park of available single humans, no hip laundromat in which to conveniently forget my dryer sheets so I can ask a handsome stranger for one of his. My dating profile was pretty perfect, I thought. My friend Jill says that I joke too much, that people are scared off by someone who tries to make herself seem so clever. But I swear to God, that's how I really think, and not just some internet shtick. I just can't do the requisite, I love baby animals, and feigned interest in trying out new cuisine, and pretending to live every day to its fullest, which doesn't really even mean anything anyway. Why do people say that? What impression are they hoping to make? I watch TV all day and leave the house only for snacks. This is the fullness that I am living. The last book I'd read at the time was Gods Without Men, and that seemed really impressive to me, especially since I had to haul that doorstop pretentiously around on the train for a week while I finished it. Couple a handful of boring half-truths with half a dozen real pictures of my real body, weighty boobs and meaty backside and the outline of a belly in this one where I'm leaning over to blow out birthday candles on a neon blue cake. No flattering Instagram filtration, no angled duck face surrounded by a group of my most attractive and nubile friends. The last thing I ever want to do is show up to a bar to meet a person who is expecting to meet the quarter of my sweating meat beard I didn't crop out of the one photo I wasn't too embarrassed to post. Because potential dates will drag me in front of the firing squad, yes? I had read many a snarky think piece centered on blind dates derailed by the super mean, lying liar face who'd broken some naive young man's heart by having the sheer audacity to arrive at the predetermined meeting place fatter than she'd advertised. I wasn't going to be that lady. But I was going to make shit awkward. I clumsily knocked a bowl of mussels into prospective boyfriend Michael's lap after wagging my tail at the bar, wildly happy that our fever dream of a courtship was starting to gel into something real, despite the fact that I had worn a diaper to a De La Soul show we'd seen the week before, that I had successfully hidden most of my maladies long enough to win him over with my personality. Michael was a person who had lived in my computer for a very long time before we actually met in person. That kind of shit used to happen to me all the fucking time when I was trying to get the internet to find me a goddamn boyfriend. Superficial asshole with decent taste in music finds my dating profile witty yet approachable, sends me a message despite the fact that plus size was the only available body type box he hadn't checked, starts lobbying in earnest to become my new best male friend. Except who the fuck ever got on OkCupid to find another one of those? My best guy friend is like the fat girl consolation prize, and if we're all being honest with ourselves, I'm not looking for another person to eat greasy cheesesteaks in my pajamas with. I have Brooke for that. But, like the inner thighs of my most beloved dark wash, curvy fit, slightly flared jeans, I wore Michael down. Not through any wizardry of my own. There's just only so long you can keep having the best conversations of your life before you decide to get over your weird fear of bloated ankles and ask that fat bitch you can't stop rushing home to email to meet you in a bar you know your friends won't be at so you can make each other laugh in person. And things were going okay, I think. We'd gone out a handful of times, already had a number of inside jokes. I'd given him my last two Advil when he got a headache at roller derby. Then, blammo, I'm wedged next to where he's sitting at the bar making jokes while he tries to figure out a way to both eat muscles and look cool. And one careless gesture later, the bowl is in his lap and people on either side of us are doing that horrified, jumping out of the way thing panicky people in close quarters do. Like if they don't squeal and knock bar stools over, the Ebola virus you just spilled is going to splash all over them. Michael didn't text me ever again after that, and I get it. He'd suffered a lap full of lukewarm beer broth in the middle of a trendy restaurant at my hand, and I get it. But I was disappointed nonetheless because he'd made me a mixtape, an actual burn CD with the artists and song titles printed neatly on a sheet of accompanying notebook paper. That is the kind of thing that signifies the possibility of true love. I've been accused often over the years of not being romantic, but here's where it all oozes out. A list of songs felt by you and presented to me, rendering me flushed and swooning and poring over song lyrics to determine their hidden meaning. The week I spent afterward, one when I pretended to be indifferent to the deafening silence coming from my phone, created a self-consciousness in me that couldn't be explained away by some imaginary event on his side of the universe. I had fucked that whole thing up royally. Back into my celibate cocoon I retreated, and I stayed there for 2 years, which, contrary to what you might think, made me realize how much sex I actually don't need. I mourned that relationship with Fred. I mourned it hard. Wrote a eulogy, had a funeral, shed a few tears, put flowers on its grave. When you break up with an asshole, it's easy to just set fire to the shit and move on. But no one talks to you about ending a relationship that never sucked, kinda amicably, with your homie, whom you still love to a degree, and for whom you sort of want the best. No, you actually want him to be prosperous and happy. Not more prosperous or happy than you are, for sure, or all up in your face with it, but you aren't actively wishing for homeboy to wind up homeless or hit by a city bus. I felt robbed, cheated of my silly daydreams of scribbling manuscript notes in a Moleskine, as Fred stood in front of a nearby easel painting while listening to Kind of Blue on vinyl. But I wasn't really mad at him. And I found myself wondering what he was doing. A lot. I'd hear a Quadron song and have to resist the urge to text him about it. Or I'd throw my phone across the room like a grenade to keep from calling him to talk about a hilarious episode of Black Dynamite. I wanted to see Hiatus Coyote at the Double Door with him. I wanted to take him to this Afghani spot I had found in the suburbs with the most delicious mantu and murk chalau. I wanted to get his opinion on holistic remedies for my shitty, failing knees. I wanted my fucking friend back. I dipped a toe in the water and almost got frostbite. In 6 months, I'd gone from heartbroken baby animal to Facebook deleter and blocker, and the response I received to my "I'm ready to be friends again" email was terse and cold and suspicious. Because in Fred's mind, We still could have been friends all along. He didn't not love me. I didn't not love him. We just weren't each other's person. But reasonable though it may have been, that talk had left me touchy and defensive, so I let his emails and texts go unanswered while I licked my never-gonna-spend-the-morning cuddled at the Hyde Park Library together wounds. I didn't take any parting shots before quietly scrubbing that picture of us at Big Star from my timeline. No nasty voicemail warning him never to call me ever again, and I assumed that guaranteed my seamless reentry into his life when I finally got enough distance from the hurt to allow him back into mine. I suggested Au Cheval for dinner, because that place is loud and sexy and dark, and I knew that Fred would pay for however many $14 cocktails I ordered, plus maybe a cheeseburger. I made sure to wear basic dishwater gray friend clothes and my house glasses. I probably didn't even wear deodorant, because this was a friend meeting between friends. When he walked in, I was flooded with relief, and when he bent to wrap his arms firmly around me, I nearly burst into tears. I'm not often very good at exposing my innermost feelings. I am self-deprecating. I avoid tough conversations. I joke my way through uncomfortable emotional moments. But I stood in a corner of that restaurant and poured out my soppy feelings, and I listened to Fred pour out his, and we started laying the groundwork for a friendship. And I'm not even gonna front. I have never been able to navigate a post-relationship relationship with someone whose testicles have been in my mouth, but somehow this is working. Maybe in this life you get all kinds of soulmates. Multiple people who vibrate at the same level you do. I think that's what Fred is for me. I just don't get to see his penis anymore. So no, I didn't get my happy ending tongue kiss in the rain, but I did get my friend back, and I don't have to worry about running these busted knees around after any babies. The Miracle Porker. I never even wanted a pet. I've spent the last 14 years of my life running the reception desk at an animal hospital, and do you know what that means? It means I can give you 11 billion real-life reasons why letting a dog or cat take up residence in the shadowy corners of your home, scratching up your children, vomiting in your shoes, caterwauling all hours of the goddamn night, is a bad fucking idea. Right now, while I'm in Detroit drinking my very first Faygo in a sunny loft overlooking the river and glaring at people enjoying themselves below, my feline companion, Helen, is in Chicago, probably definitely pressing her moist butthole against all the clean surfaces in my apartment. She is a pig demon from hell, sent to my life as payback for all the vicious thought crimes I've committed against people who listen to music on the bus without headphones, people who keep loose change in their actual pockets, people who host sit-down dinner parties in their young, marginally successful person apartments. 7 years ago, Ken, one of the vets at the animal hospital, rolled into work with a shoebox tucked under his arm. Inside was a shivering, hairy ball of mucus the size of a child's fist. It was a baby cat, crawling with fleas, and too small to even really have eyes. And the high-pitched screeching sounds it was making made me want to cut my own throat. I ignored it. I was standing in the kennel washing out my breakfast dishes in the dog tub and would be having no part of that mewling lump of roundworms and giardia. It was too small and slimy and gross to do anything. Feed itself, pee on its own, look even remotely adorable. "Aw, it's too bad that rat is gonna die," I muttered to myself as Lori, the head technician, gently placed it into an incubator. Then I went into the break room to make my oatmeal. I am not ordinarily immune to the charms of a cutie pie kitten with its itty-bitty whiskers and teeny-tiny nose, but the minute Ken walked by, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up and told me that something was up with that repulsive thing. It had the mark of the beast. Helen's mother was a local stray that kept a